Hi, everyone. First of all, I want to thank FOSDEM for having me, also the HPC Dev Room for having me, and thanks to all of you for being here. Today I want to talk partly, I want to present my talk, which is partly Cloudy with a Chance of SAR, a virtualized approach to SAR stores from ECMWS field database. I'm Tobias Kremer. I'm a research software engineer at ECMWF, and I'm a former cloud backend engineer working for ECM for, on this day, exactly 2 years. And I'm also part of the One World Easier project, to collaborating with colleagues from JSC, DKRZ, MPI, JEREX, KIT, and University of Cologne. At ECMWF, I'm working mainly on the Mars ecosystem. Mars is an abbreviation for our meteorological archive and retrieval system, storing all of our forecast data. So just a huge archive, if you want to say it like this. And I'm mainly working on the fields database, which is abbreviated FDB, a caching layer on top of the actual archive. And I'm also working on interfaces to this FDB, mainly the Python interface and the XAR interface, which we want to have a look at today. What is ECMWF? It's an intergovernmental organization established in 1975, consists out of 23 member states and 12 cooperating states, and we just recently crossed the 500 headcount number for employees. We have 24/7 operational services, doing operational numerical weather prediction, and having four forecasts a day, supporting national weather services with coupled models, and also businesses downstream. And on top of that, we are a research institution and doing experiments to continuously improve our models, also doing reforecasts and climate analysis. On the right-hand side, you can see the three sites, and I'm stationed in Bonn. So, sorry, why are we actually talking about SAR today? Well, recently, and recently is a vague term in that sense, but over the last 10 or 15 years maybe, we saw a huge explosion in scientific data. We at ECMWF currently produce 360 terabytes of forecast data a day, and there is a projection for that to cross the petabyte threshold in 2027. On the right-hand side, you can see the image. What the individual lines are doesn't really matter currently, but the blue one is basically the overall archive, and as you can see, in 2025 we crossed the exabyte scale or threshold for the entire archive. On top of that, we're seeing an increasing pool of target users coming from all different domains, for example social science and geologists, not only meteorological or climate users, and as well, we're seeing more and more users rushing in from the Python side, doing, for example, machine learning or AI. Our normal and HPC use cases are mainly driven by the forecast, right? So we're doing numerical weather prediction workflows, writing and reading to parallel file systems, and of course also analysis of forecasts in weather and climate. And also, so if we take a look at what the users actually are keen on to do with the data, we've seen a shift in the recent years. There are many hybrid workflows, so combining HPC with actual cloud workflows or pipelines, and people are in general really interested in having semantic data storage in the cloud. Also doing interactive analysis, explorative work, or ML training on large data sets. In general, one could say people are really keen on having analysis-ready, cloud-optimized data sets. On the right-hand side, I've brought an example for such a use case. This is the Error Explorer. You can explore climatological data, and in this case, the user was asking for a time series data of precipitation in millimeter per month of Brussels. And in the HPC use cases, we normally write the entire state of the atmosphere for each individual simulation step of the model to our file systems, and you can see that the use case in the case of the request of the user is completely orthogonal to that access pattern, because he or she is requesting a time series, right? So the overall question which naturally arises is, can we actually give flexible access to the data and do that so that even non-domain people have a nice time? So the goal of this talk is actually to show how SAR, because SAR is something which is quite familiar and quite popular in the Python ecosystem, is fitting to this HPC use case and also how this fits together with the already implemented open source solution we have in place. And we want to bridge the gap between the classical HPC approaches and more modern cloud-based solutions, right? Or in, if you want to take this diagram, how do we actually fill in this question mark there? So to be able to do this, we need to talk about the individual pieces of the chain, right? So starting on the right-hand side, we're talking about the FDB. The FDB is a domain-specific high-performance storage object store. It's transactional, has no explicit synchronization, does all the synchronization on a file system level, and there's no MPI involved. In general, you can think of it as a key object store, where the key is some meteorological metadata, and the values are just binary data, can be GRIP files or ODB files. An example for such a key in this object store is written on the left-hand side, down below on the slide, and you can see this are just different meteorological variables and values describing the actual data saved there. On the right-hand side, you can see the operational setup. We have different numerical weather prediction models running, which are outputting the data in an FDB, and the FDB is then distributing this data over different backends. Could be DAOs, Sephrados, or a Lustre file system. And the models are outputting the mass metadata and the data itself, and this is typically done in a GRIP file format, so we need to talk about GRIP a bit. What is GRIP? GRIP is an abbreviation for General Regularly Distributed Information in Binary Form. This is a short one, right? And is in general just storing gridded fields, really. And the field is a scalar vector field, could be temperature or pressure. On the left-hand side, there's a picture depicting a normal GRIP field. So this is really, for in that example, 2 meter temperature on the surface of the globe. But it can also be, like, as I said, pressure on different height levels. GRIP is standardized by the WMO for Meteorological Data Exchange. It's a binary format, compact, so has certain capabilities in compression, and is efficient for large numerical weather prediction data sets. It's optimized for archival workflows, or in general our operational workflows. It's really good at sequential access. It has a very minimal overhead for all the things we're doing in our operation pipelines, and it's self-describing, meaning that what I said on the last slide as well, the metadata and the actual values are stored in the same file right next to each other on the disk. But there are also some downsides. For example, it's a rather complex format. You have some tables on top describing the metadata, and in case you want to read the GRIP file, you need to have those tables to be able to restore the metadata completely. And also, because it was initially designed in 1985, this obviously predates cloud-native use cases. In the lower part of the slide, you can see such a GRIP file structure on disk. There are different sections for the metadata, and section 7 is typically where the data is stored. All the other sections are certain sections of the metadata. So finally, we also need to talk about ZAR to make the last piece of this chain. What is ZAR, actually? It's two things, really. It's a library and it's a format, but you could also say it's an API and behavioral contract. By definition, it's a chunk compressed in n-dimensional data format. To the user, it looks somewhat like a NumPy array, although they introduce chunking on top. Chunking is just a fancy way of saying, instead of querying the entire array all the time, I'm querying subsections of the array, and those subsections are then returned to the user. The key features of ZAR is that it's storage agnostic, so it doesn't really matter or appear to the user where the actual ZAR store is located. Could be on a local file system, could be in an S3 bucket. It has a great language interoperability. There are many different programming languages implementing features for the, or implementing clients for the ZAR library. Chunking I already mentioned, and in general it's a hierarchical format mapping groups or arrays and chunks to the corresponding file system objects, right? So groups are mapped to directories, arrays are mapped to set of files, and each chunk is one file on the file system. All right. So to answer the question, how do we actually bridge the gap between GRIP and ZAR? I want to talk about the local use case first, so where the FDB is running locally, and also the user is doing only local requests. So we came up with a solution for bridging this gap as follows. the user, first of all, inserts this metadata we've seen earlier. This can be arbitrary metadata, really, whatever data the user is interested in, and is handing that to the CFFDB layer. And this knows exactly how to query certain metadata about this request the user just queried, and is asking the FTP for this metadata. The FTP is then returning this information and is returning a virtual view, we called it, to the user. This is just a ZAR store, but the ZAR store does not contain any data yet, so everything in there is lazy. There can be groups and arrays within the store, really like arbitrary structure, but nothing is loaded yet. It's just like a virtual description of what could be in there. If we condense this image now to this, we now have our ZAR store the user can interact with, but we also need to be able to query something from this. So as soon as the user tries to access an array, I mentioned earlier already that then certain chunks get loaded, right? So what the user is doing, it's he or she is accessing the array, and then the chunks underneath get queried from the ZAR group and array. And because the ZAR group array knows exactly which stores it's part of, the implementation of ours is then able to map this inquiry to a mass request and sending this to the FTP. The FTP is then returning those bytes of the ZAR file back to the array, and the chunk gets actually delivered to the user. And this is the high-level explanation of what is going on, this two-step approach between first defining the actual view and then querying the data from the actual database. To give you an overview how this looks, here the code is more or less readable. If not, it's not a big deal, because what I just wanted to show with that piece of code is how concisely you can define such a virtual store or such a virtual view. There's actually in that example a little bit more going on. So there are two parts which we define, and each part is could be a request to some meteorological data, and those are virtual arrays. They are not really existing in the ZAR store, as I just described. They are just the mapping which has to be done when accessing the files from the FTP, right? And those are, in that case, concatenated together. And the initial requests are four-dimensional, but they are mapped with the access definitions to an actual two-dimensional array in the ZAR world. So this is also shown on the diagram on the lower part of the slide. So there are two lazy views. They are concatenated together and they end up in a ZAR array. And the dimensions you can see right below this ZAR sign. The first dimension of this actual mapped array is the datetime dimension, so where the date and the time of the initial metadata is mapped together to one dimension. And then the second dimension is the parameter and level list dimension, where the same thing happened with the parameter and the level list. And the third dimension, although I just said that it's a two-dimensional array, the third dimension is implicit, and it stores all the values of the grip files we query from the FTP. Okay. Now we want to talk about the remote case, actually, right? Because want to bridge the gap between the HPC and the remote user. And ZAR has a lot of capabilities in that regard already. So if you ever used ZAR, you probably are aware that there is a HTTP store, and you can just hand it a certain URL to a data file somewhere located on a server, and it's just able to open it, and the user is able to access the content. This is what is depicted on the left-hand side with the ARCO dataset. In our case, because we had to implement this two-step approach for first virtually defining the view and then querying the data, we needed a slightly beefier implementation of the client and the server. All right? So the client and the server, as shown in this picture, take care of this two-step approach, and they are communicating over a compressed HTTPS. But once we're on the server side, on the HPC, everything happens exactly like I just described for the local case. So how would that look like? The first step would be the client triggers the creation of a virtual view. The server then creates this virtual view of the FTP data as described earlier and is returning the URL to the user. and or to the client, and the client then is able to open the virtual view via an FS spec store and send the chunk request back to the server. Once the server gets the request, it's querying the chunk data from the FTP because it knows how to map the request and sends the bytes once it has it from the FTP back to the client. And to the client, it looks like the actual data was stored locally, and this is the entire process. So to summarize, what have we seen? I think it's the easiest way is to have a look at the diagram. Basically, we are able to extract data from the FTP directly via creating virtual views, which can be concatenated. This is not necessary. This is an optional step, right? But can be done by the user, and then it's handed to the SAR user. And really, the user only queries the data once it's hitting the certain chunk. That's everything I have so far. Thanks a lot for your attention, and I want to thank the BMFT for sponsoring that project, and also all of my colleagues who collaborated on the topic with me. And yeah, I'm looking forward to your questions. So the question was, there are certain files which may be HDF, NetCDF, and so on, and whether they needs to be converted to SAR, right, to be usable. So there is a certain library you can use, which is called Virtually SAR. We have nothing to do with this. This is part of the SAR ecosystem, right? And this is basically able to open NetCDF, HDF, I think, to some extent, GRIP files, which are not stored in the FTP, just on a random file system as well, and display them as a SAR, very close to this virtual approach we implemented, but like a bit more general with other file systems as well, right? So that would be the option you have there. Without, so there's no need for converting this, but you could use this library. So I actually brought as well a link collection. Oh yes, sorry. So the question was whether the API is already available, right? So the local use case is already living in the FTP repository here. The client-server thing I showed is under development, but it's going to hit this also rather soon. Thanks. Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. So the view is, so the question was whether the there's a state saved on the server, right, which persists the view. And this is actually done. So currently we are just holding the view a certain user created, hashed in memory, and this is reused once another user queries the same view, right? There are some open questions in that regard. For example, if you have a lot of like overlap between requests, what do you do? But this is more or less open. Yep.
Related to that question, is virtual SAR stateless, and your approach sort of like keeps this cache view on the server? Is that the difference between the
virtual? So the question was whether the virtual SAR stateless and whether ours has the state. I'm not entirely sure how virtual SAR works under the hood, right? I'm not affiliated with the project or anything. I think the two-step approach is hidden in the virtual SAR stuff because there has to be mapping as well. I'm not entirely sure. All right, if there are no further questions, thanks a lot.